You know that feeling, right? That internal tug of war when you really need to say no or maybe set a boundary, but the pressure to just say yes, or maybe it's the fear of disappointing someone. It just creates this knot of anxiety or, guilt.
Oh, absolutely. That conflict is so common.
It really is. Feeling obligated versus needing to protect your own time, your energy. Well, if that resonates with you, and let's be honest, it probably resonates with most of us, then this deep dive, it's going to offer you a really powerful shortcut, I think.
Good.
We're digging into the core principles and like the practical techniques from a really foundational work in assertiveness training. It's Manuel J. Smith's classic 1975 book, When I Say No, I Feel Guilty.
A real cornerstone text in this field.
Exactly. We're taking the source material you've shared, sort of analyzing the analysis, if you will, just to distill what's most important.
Makes sense.
So our mission today is really to unpack the key insights from this book, help you understand how to navigate those tricky interactions with more self-assurance, set boundaries effectively, and hopefully say no without that awful wave of guilt.
And it's interesting how directly Smith tackles that feeling of guilt head on. I mean, this wasn't just about manners or etiquette. His approach, he actually called it assertive therapy, is fundamentally about empowering people.
Sort of therapy, huh?
It's not about becoming aggressive or pushy. It's about developing confident communication that respects both yourself and the other person. And he gives real practical tools to get there.
Okay, let's unpack this then. Where does Smith even start? Like, what's the foundation of this whole assertiveness philosophy?
Well, at the very heart of it, he lays out something he considers fundamental, the Bill of Assertive Rights.
Build assertive rights, okay.
Think of it like your personal constitution for self-respect and, how you interact with others. It's a set of 10 core principles.
None of them.
And they basically give you explicit permission to, to exist, to feel, to act without needing someone else's okay, especially when what you need conflicts with what they want. And our source highlights a few key ones that really challenge how we often think we should act. Things like, you have the right to say no without feeling guilty.
Wow. Just hearing that feels kind of radical for some people, I bet.
It really can. And another, you have the right to judge your own behavior, thoughts, and emotions, not someone else judging them for you.
Right. Taking back control.
And crucially, you have the right to make mistakes and be responsible for them. These aren't things other people grant you. They're rights you claim for yourself.
That idea, judging your own behavior, not constantly looking over your shoulder for approval or, fearing what others think, that really hits home. Society often pushes us the other way, doesn't it?
It absolutely does.
So if we really internalize these rights, if we start to genuinely believe we have them, what does that actually unlock for us? How does it change things day to day?
Well, if you connect this to the bigger picture, internalizing these rights is really the essential groundwork. It lets you resist manipulation, resist undue pressure, whether it's personal or professional.
All right.
So in your personal life, it empowers you to say no to, say, unreasonable requests from family or friends without feeling like you're letting them down or being selfish.
Yeah, that guilt trip.
And professionally, it's what allows you to advocate for what you need, maybe negotiate your workload, or comfortably decline extra tasks when you're already swamped.
Or even just speak up in a difficult meeting, maybe.
Stand up for yourself respectfully. It's that really crucial shift away from being passive or even aggressive sometimes towards genuine assertiveness. And that fosters healthier relationships, relationships built on mutual respect, and it really boosts your self-esteem.
Okay, so the Bill of Rights is the foundation. It's believing you can be assertive. But now, the how. How do we actually do it? The source material gets into some very practical techniques Smith laid out. Let's dive into those tools.
These techniques are the actionable methods. And one of the most famous ones is called the broken record.
Broken record. Like a scratched LP.
It involves calmly, persistently repeating your original statement or your stance. The goal isn't to argue. It's not to justify yourself endlessly.
Wow.
It's just to state your position clearly and stick to it without getting sidetracked by the other person trying to guilt you or manipulate you or pull you into totally irrelevant arguments.
Okay, give me an example from the source. How does this look in a real situation? Like, personally?
Okay, so let's say a friend keeps pushing you, really badgering you to help them move house on a Saturday you've already set aside for just relaxing, recharging.
Okay, yeah. Happens all the time.
You've already said clearly, I'm not available this weekend, but they push back, right?
Yeah.
But I really need your help. What am I going to do?
Yep, the guilt starts.
Instead of getting flustered or making up long excuses, you just calmly repeat, I understand you need help, but I'm not available this weekend.
Same exact words.
Pretty much, or very close. If they try another angle, come on, you owe me one.
Yeah.
You just repeat again, calmly. I understand, but I'm not available this weekend. The power isn't really in the words. It's in the calm, consistent persistence.
So it's like you're refusing to get emotionally hooked by their reaction,
Yeah.
just stating the boundary and letting their stuff kind of bounce off.
Precisely. That's the strategic nugget here. You deny them the emotional leverage they might be trying to use. And delivered calmly, it isn't rude. It's just a clear, unwavering boundary.
Okay. And professionally, how does broken record work there?
Same idea. Maybe a colleague asks you to take on an extra project piece when you genuinely don't have the bandwidth.
Right.
Your response, I can't take on more work right now. Simple. If they persist, but it's really urgent, you just repeat, maybe varying slightly for politeness. I appreciate the opportunity, or I understand it's urgent, but I really can't take on more work right now.
Firm, respectful, and shuts down the debate before it starts.
Exactly. No endless back and forth.
Got it. Okay, what's next?
Next up is a technique called fogging.
Fogging, like creating confusion.
Hey, it sounds a bit like that, but it's actually incredibly effective. It involves calmly agreeing with any truthful or potentially valid or even just possible aspect of a criticism someone throws at you.
Wait, agreeing with criticism, doesn't that just like validate their attack or make you look weak?
That's the surprising part. See, the genius of fogging is that it totally takes the wind out of the critic's sails. You're not agreeing with their conclusion or their negative judgment of you.
Okay.
You're just acknowledging a factual point or an arguable point within their statement without getting defensive.
Give me an example.
Okay, so personally, maybe your partner says, a bit accusingly, you're always too busy to spend time with me.
Ouch. Classic.
Right. A fogging response could be, you know, you're right, I have been very busy lately.
So you're not saying, yes, I'm a terrible partner who's always too busy.
Exactly. You're not agreeing with the implied judgment. Always. Never care. You're just agreeing with the observable fact. Yes, my schedule has been busy. It validates their observation without conceding fault.
Ah, I see. You acknowledge their feeling or perception without accepting the negative label. It defuses the conflict
Yeah.
because what are they going to argue with?
Precisely. There's nothing left to fight against on that specific point. Professionally, maybe a manager critiques your work. Your report could have been more detailed.
Okay.
Instead of jumping to defend it, you could use fogging. You're right, I probably could add more detail in some sections.
So you're agreeing that more detail is possible.
Yes, which is almost always factually true. You're not agreeing the report was bad or insufficient or that you were lazy. The key nugget here is acknowledging their perspective. I hear that you see it this way, without internalizing it as, therefore I am bad wrong. And crucially, without getting defensive, it keeps you in control and shows you're open to feedback, but on your terms.
That's subtle but powerful.
Yeah.
Okay, what else is in the toolkit?
Then there's something called negative assertion.
Negative assertion sounds negative.
Well, it's about handling negativity differently. It encourages you to accept your actual mistakes or flaws without excessive self-criticism, without making excuses, and without drowning in guilt. It's about owning your imperfections calmly.
Oh, okay. This sounds like a tough one for perfectionists or anyone who hates admitting they messed up.
It definitely can be because we're often taught to hide mistakes or deflect blame, right?
Yeah.
But the power of negative assertion lies in fostering self-acceptance. It actually reduces the fear of judgment because you kind of get ahead of it or at least handle it with dignity when it comes.
How does that one?
The source gives the example of forgetting a friend's birthday. They call you out instead of a long, rambling, guilt-soaked apology.
Which can sometimes make it worse.
Right. You use negative assertion. You're absolutely right. I completely forgot, and I'm really sorry. Let's plan something soon to celebrate properly. You own the mistake clearly, apologize sincerely but briefly, and immediately focus on a solution.
So you admit the fault, but you don't wallow in shame. You move forward. How about professionally? If you miss a deadline, say, due to an oversight, no excuses.
Exactly. No long stories about why. You'd tell your boss, perhaps, I messed up on the timeline for this project. I take responsibility and I'll make sure it doesn't happen again. It shows accountability without groveling or losing your self-respect.
Right.
The nugget is that calmly owning a genuine mistake often earns more respect in the long run than trying to cover it up or blame circumstances or other people. It actually builds trust.
Makes sense.
Okay,
what's the next one?
Another really useful tool is negative inquiry.
Negative inquiry, asking negative questions.
Sort of. When you receive criticism, especially if it feels vague or maybe unfair or even potentially manipulative, this technique involves calmly asking for more specific information. You prompt the other person to clarify their complaint.
Ah, so this sounds like a way to maybe call someone's bluff, or at least understand what they really mean behind a general complaint.
Exactly right. It forces them to substantiate their claim, or it reveals that maybe there isn't much substance behind it.
How would you use this personally?
Let's say a family member throws out that line, "You never care about what I want."
Oof. Another classic guilt inducer.
Totally. Instead of immediately getting defensive, "That's not true, I always care," you'd use negative inquiry. Can you give me a specific example of a time you felt I didn't consider what you wanted?
Puts the ball back in their court.
It does. It pushes them to provide concrete feedback that you can actually discuss. Or quite often, it reveals that the statement was just an exaggeration born of frustration, or maybe even a deliberate tactic to make you feel bad.
That's incredibly useful. It shifts it from this vague, hurtful attack to a request for actual, actionable information. What about at work? How does negative inquiry play out there?
Same principle applies. If a coworker says something like, "You're just not pulling your weight on this team."
Whoa. Okay, that's a big accusation.
It is. So instead of reacting emotionally, you ask calmly, "Could you tell me what specific task you feel I haven't contributed enough to? Or where exactly do you see a lack of effort?"
Forcing them to be specific.
Yes. It forces them to either point to actual instances, which gives you something concrete you can potentially address or refute, or it reveals they're just making a broad, perhaps unfair, accusation without real evidence. The nugget here is that negative inquiry takes the power out of vague criticism by demanding clarity. It turns a potential attack into either potentially constructive feedback or an exposed manipulation.
Very clever. Okay, is there one more technique?
Yes. The last major one Smith talks about is workable compromise.
Okay, compromise. That sounds more straightforward.
It is, in a way. This is the technique for those situations where maybe a flat no isn't the best or only option, but your needs or desires genuinely conflict with someone else's. It's about finding a middle ground. But crucially, it's a middle ground that respects both parties' assertive rights. It's not about you just giving in or sacrificing your core boundaries or well-being to keep the peace.
So not completely caving, but also not being totally rigid if there's some flexibility?
Exactly. It's about negotiation, but negotiation rooted in mutual respect. So for instance, in a personal scenario, your spouse wants to spend every single holiday with their family, but you feel strongly about having some holidays just at home or with your family.
Okay.
A workable compromise isn't one person just giving in year after year. It might be proposing something like, "Okay, how about we spend Christmas with your family this year, and then we make sure we're definitely home for New Year's Eve," or alternating years or some other arrangement.
So you identify the conflicting needs, their need for family time, your need for home time, and propose a specific solution that gives something to both sides without you totally abandoning your preference.
Yes, exactly. And professionally, maybe your boss asks you to stay late to finish an urgent task, but you have a really important personal commitment you absolutely cannot miss.
Right, conflict.
A workable compromise isn't just saying yes and ditching your plans, nor is it necessarily just saying no and walking out the door if the task is genuinely critical.
So what could it be?
It could be suggesting alternatives. "I understand this is urgent, but I can't stay late tonight because I have a prior commitment I can't break. However, I can come in an hour early tomorrow to finish it, or I can take the necessary files home and log back on to complete it after my commitment ends tonight."
Showing flexibility and acknowledging the urgency, but still protecting your personal time boundary.
Precisely. You acknowledge their need and offer a concrete alternative solution that respects your boundary. The key nugget with workable compromise is recognizing that assertiveness isn't always about winning or just saying no. Sometimes it's about creatively finding solutions that honor everyone's legitimate needs while firmly protecting your own non-negotiables.
Okay, these techniques of the broken record, fogging, negative assertion, negative inquiry, and workable compromise, wow. When you put them together with that foundation, the Bill of Assertive Rights, It really does sound like a comprehensive toolkit for handling difficult situations.
It really is.
And the source material brings them to life with those specific examples, right?
Yeah.
People actually using them.
Absolutely. The source shares these relatable stories, like someone named Sarah using the broken record technique with her, let's say, demanding mother, and finding that over time, it actually reduced the tension because the boundaries just became clearer.
Less room for argument, maybe.
Yeah. Or John using fogging when a critical friend called him selfish. He managed to diffuse the friend's frustration and keep the conversation somewhat constructive instead of it just blowing up.
Mm-hmm.
Professionally, too. There was Maria, who used negative inquiry when she felt overwhelmed by her workload. Asking for specifics actually led to a negotiation with her manager and resulted in a more manageable schedule.
That's a great outcome.
Yeah. And Tom, who used negative assertion when a colleague criticized his presentation, by calmly owning a small flaw, the colleague pointed out, he actually built trust and reinforced his own confidence rather than getting defensive.
And Lisa, using assertiveness in a performance review.
Right, for salary negotiation. Presenting her achievements confidently, possibly using elements of workable compromise if needed, really increased her chances of a positive outcome. These aren't just theories. They have tangible results.
They really do. So these aren't just abstract concepts. They clearly have real-world impact in both parts of life.
They absolutely do. And the source explicitly connects these applications back to the broader benefits we see. In personal life, it leads to healthier, more authentic relationships. You see less resentment building up.
Oh, yeah. Resentment is a big one.
Huge. And you see increased mutual respect and just the ability to genuinely prioritize your own well-being without feeling racked with guilt afterwards.
And professionally.
Professionally, these skills translate directly into things like enhanced leadership. Potential assertive people are often seen as more capable leaders. Better negotiation outcomes, obviously. Greater respect in the workplace. Increased job satisfaction. And really importantly, lower rates of burnout.
Burnout is such a massive issue.
It is. And the source even points to studies, particularly in areas like organizational psychology, that show a direct correlation. Assertive communication styles link up with higher reported job satisfaction and significantly lower burnout risk.
It all sounds incredibly positive, almost like a cure-all. But implementing this, especially after years, maybe decades, of being more passive or perhaps even aggressive, they can't be easy, right? The source mentions challenges.
Oh, it's definitely not a magic wand. And yes, the challenges are significant. It's really important we acknowledge those. One of the biggest is simply breaking those deeply ingrained habits.
Yeah, old habits die hard.
They really do. If your default setting for years has been, say, people-pleasing or maybe avoiding conflict at all costs, then the actual physical and emotional act of asserting yourself, it can feel incredibly unnatural at first, almost wrong.
I can imagine. Like you're being rude or selfish.
Exactly. And there's also the potential for misunderstanding. While true assertiveness isn't aggression, let's be real, in some contexts, or especially maybe in cultures that really value deference and more indirect communication styles, being direct, even politely direct, might be perceived as aggressive by some people.
That's a tricky one to navigate.
It is. And probably the most crucial challenge. Effectively using these techniques requires real emotional regulation. You have to be able to stay calm, especially when you're facing pressure or criticism or maybe someone's getting emotional with you. That's key.
So what does the source suggest? Any tips for overcoming these hurdles?
Yeah, it wisely suggests starting small. Don't try to tackle your most terrifying conflict first. Practice these techniques in low-stakes situations first. You know, build that confidence muscle gradually.
Like ordering coffee exactly how you want it, maybe.
Something like that. And it reinforces that how you deliver the message, staying calm, maintaining respectful body language, is absolutely essential for making sure you come across as assertive, not aggressive.
Okay. Yeah. So bringing it all together then. Manuel J. Smith's When I Say No, I Feel Guilty, as we've explored through this source material, it really offers a remarkably relevant and timeless set of tools, doesn't it?
It really holds up.
By grounding yourself in that Bill of Assertive Rights, really internalizing your permission to prioritize yourself, and then consciously practicing these techniques,
right?
Broken record, fogging, negative assertion, negative inquiry, workable compromise, you really do gain a practical framework.
A framework for navigating countless personal and professional challenges with hopefully much greater confidence and much less guilt.
Yeah.
And the core message, I think, is genuinely empowering. It's that you can prioritize your own needs and your feelings without carrying that suffocating burden of guilt. as the source puts it quite nicely, saying no when you need to isn't inherently selfish. When it's done assertively, it can actually be a deeply liberating act for you and often for the other person too, because it sets clearer expectations and fosters more honest interactions in the long run.
Okay, so thinking about those challenges we just discussed, especially how hard it can be to break those old patterns, those deeply ingrained habits, and also the potential for assertiveness to be misinterpreted, depending on, you know, who you're talking to or the cultural context. Mm. Here's something to think about. How might consistently practicing this kind of assertive communication day in, day out, over a longer period of time? How might that fundamentally reshape not just how other people interact with you, but maybe even your own internal sense of identity, your self-worth, your core confidence? What do you think stands out as the deepest, perhaps most transformative, long-term impact of really living by these principles?